Hi,
my name is Ilyas Mahenna. I'm the author of the Kiffin Ebki blog on Lebanese political affairs and a visiting fellow at Stanford University's Center for Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law.
And I'm Mona Yacoubi, and I'm the Senior Program Officer for the Middle East and North Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where I also direct the Lebanon Working Group.
Hi, Mona.
How are you, Kifa? How are you, Ilyas?
I'm doing very well. We're here to talk about the situation in Lebanon. As some of you may know, Lebanon has a new government, which is a big deal because it's taken them 4.5 months to get this far. The new government is headed by somebody named Najib Mikati, who is a billionaire businessman who made his fortune in the telecoms industry. He's from the northern city of Tripoli. He's a Sunni, and he is taking over from the former prime minister, Saad al-Hariri, who is also a billionaire, also a Sunni, and the son of the assassinated former prime minister, Rafiq al-Hariri. And Najib Mikati takes over at a moment, at a very contentious or very sensitive moment in recent Lebanese political history. And we're going to be talking about what the issues are for this government going forward, what the major questions facing the various political parties are, why this government is momentous, and so on. Mona, do you have anything you want to say right off the bat, or should I sort of sum things up? Go ahead.
Well, I think the most important point to note with this new government is that it is dominated by what's known as the March 8th coalition. And in Lebanese politics, there are basically today two basic alliances. One is known as the March 14th alliance, the one that's led by now former Prime Minister Saad Hariri. And this is an alliance that is certainly, I would say, more Western-leaning, more pro-U.S., pro-Europe, and fairly anti-Syrian. The other alliance is the March 8th alliance, and that is the one that is currently now dominating and heading the government. And I think this is perhaps the most important point to note about this new government, is that it is largely, again, dominated by March 8th, and I think therefore provoking concerns that Lebanon could be tilting away from the West and towards Syria and Iran.
Certainly, that's what the mainstream media and many Lebanese officials and Western government officials, certainly the way they portrayed it, that Lebanon is now, that there's been a major change in its politics, that it is now dominated by this March 8th coalition, which includes notably the Shiite political party and militia Hezbollah and its ally Amal and their major Christian ally, Michel Aoun, who heads a party called the Free Patriotic Movement. This coalition has been traditionally, I mean, at least since 2005, when these coalitions were formed, the March 14th and the March 8th, the March 8th coalition has been basically in the opposition since 2005, either in the opposition or as the junior partner in a national unity kind of formula. And what's notable is that they are now wearing the pants there is no national unity formula right now. They are actually heading a majority cabinet, which is the other notable aspect here. And it's the other thing that's making people nervous.
Right, I agree. But I would say, and maybe you would agree, Ilyas, that the reality is a bit more nuanced. Because as you note, in the Western press, it's certainly being portrayed as a Hezbollah-dominated government.
Right.
But the reality is that Hezbollah actually only has two fairly minor portfolios in this government. And interestingly, the same two portfolios it had in the previous government, which was led by Saad Hariri. So Hezbollah itself is not dominating the government per se, but rather its allies as part of this broader coalition that includes the members that you've named. They have a dominant position. However, the prime minister and the president retained, together with Druze leader Walid Jumblat, retain enough cabinet portfolio seats to have an effective veto on the government, correct?
That's right, yeah. There's 30 seats in this cabinet, 18 of which are going to the March 8th coalition, which is a majority, but not a supermajority. In Lebanese politics, you need a two-thirds plus one share of a cabinet in order to basically ram through legislation. when there's any kind of opposition. They have 18. They would need 21 mm-hmm. in order to do that. As it stands, the prime minister and the president and a couple other independents pooled together have 12 seats in this cabinet. So they form an effective veto. What's interesting about this cabinet is that it does not include any March 14th representation. No mm-hmm. representation by the coalition that has traditionally dominated Lebanese politics, at least for the last 6 years now. And that's really by design. Saad Hariri and his allies took a very clear decision not to participate in this government, and I think that is really much more significant. That's one of the very significant things about this government. Not so much that Hezbollah is participating in it. Hezbollah has participated in governments for a couple decades now almost. Not that there are anti-Western elements in this government. That has been something that's very standard about Lebanese governments in the past. What's unique, I think, about this government is that it was formed according to a majoritarian logic. That is something that is big and something new.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the question is, because it's a majoritarian government, because it's not a government of national consensus, which, as you note, is typically the way things operate in Lebanon, what does that say about the shelf life of this government? And is the fact that it's a majoritarian government, does that make it more stable or less stable? I think it's going to be fascinating to see how March 14th operates as a fully fledged opposition movement. And to what extent do we see Lebanon? I mean, there are two schools of thought on this. One is, well, Lebanon is actually is maturing politically and moving more into the realm of how democracy works, where you have the alternates of power, you have certain parties, certain alliances in power while others are in the opposition. And then depending on how they govern and their policies, things change or they don't. That's one school of thought. The other is that this is a disaster waiting to happen because it seeds further instability in a country that is already predisposed to being fairly volatile. What's your sense, Elias?
I was just about to ask you where you stood on that. My sense is I am somebody who believes that consensus, the cult of consensus has crippled Lebanese politics. That's not a controversial position. There's something to be said for consensual politics. It has certainly shielded Lebanon from many crises in the past. It has a place, but I think it has generally done more harm than good. It has paralyzed our institutions. It has made it possible for government to get nothing done. And it's basically concentrated power in the hands of, it sucked it away from the legislature, from the legislative branch, and basically put all power in the hands of these ministers who can, basically bring the entire affairs of the state to a halt by blocking legislation. And often enough, the legislation they're blocking, it's not really motivated by domestic concerns. More often than not, it's foreign interests that are playing a preponderant role in the veto politics. And so things can come to a halt in Lebanon because of these sort of regional issues that are emerging. So I actually welcome this turn towards majoritarianism. I think that it denies the majority an excuse to not get anything done, basically. They can't claim that anybody's blocking or threatening to block their legislation. Of course, the prime minister and the president can do that, but they don't have their dominant parliamentary opponents standing in their way. And so it really kind of, forces people to put their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. I think your argument has great merit, but for two what I would call X factors that are out there that could cause trouble regardless. One is the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. That we can talk about in a moment, but one that's a process that's been ongoing now for some years, a UN court that was established to prosecute those responsible for the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. And it's widely expected that tribunal is going to issue indictments that will name Hezbollah as being the prime suspects in that attack, which could in and of itself be very explosive in the Lebanese context. So we have the STL hanging out there, and of course, the unrest in Syria, which has already started to spill over a bit into Lebanon, both with respect to some refugee flows, relatively minor when compared to what's happening on the northern Syria's northern border with Turkey, and also provoking sectarian violence inside Lebanon, which has also taken place even just yesterday in Tripoli. So I think that you're right. I mean, if, in fact, Prime Minister Mikati is able to focus in on domestic issues, socioeconomic questions, which is what he said he wants to focus on, with a majoritarian government, presumably he should be able to pass and implement policies to help deal with these longstanding needs of the Lebanese population.
Yeah. No, I think that so you're taking kind of a nuanced stance here between the two schools of thought.
I am, because I think, you know, unfortunately, as is always the case with Lebanon, life is so much more complicated. And so because of both this UN tribunal, which is hanging out there, and these indictments, which are expected or anticipated to be issued at some point, presumably in the near future, as well as the unrest in Syria, which I think is frankly even the more important of the two, it's hard to see and understand how the government is going to be able to carry on the business of governing when you've got these two somewhat external issues bearing down on the country.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. And you know, one other thing I would say about what is unprecedented or new about this government, before we go on to the other issues, mm-hmm. is that the big stakeholder in this government is the Free Patriotic Movement, mm-hmm. That is led by Michel Aoun, General Michel Aoun, and you know, his party and its allies in its parliamentary bloc hold 10 ministries, and they're not kind of, you know, fluffy ministries. They're major portfolios: industry, economy. If I'm not mistaken, no, actually, economy is held by somebody else. So it's industry, tourism, telecom, energy,
right.
major ministries. Defense also is held by one of their allies. To me, that's one of the major stories. And people will argue, I've heard, you know, people on my blog have said, you know, Aoun serves at the pleasure of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Aoun serves at the pleasure of Syria. You know, he can't really do anything. His ministers can't really affect any kind of change in this government without the say-so of these other parties. To me, again, this is kind of a simplistic way of looking at things. Michel Aoun is, among all Lebanese politicians, he has cultivated a reputation for being the most recalcitrant, the most difficult to work with, the one who really puts his foot down. And he is, you know, he's sort of a maddening figure, a very frustrating figure for that reason. And I don't agree with a lot of his politics, and I've criticized, he's probably come in for the most criticism of any politician on my blog. But there's one thing you can say about that is different about the Free Patriotic Movement. When you look at the other major players historically in Lebanese politics, a case could be made that these other major heavyweight players, like Hariri and his future movement, like Hezbollah, have in certain ways used Lebanese politics as an arena to further their own extra political interests.
Mm-hmm.
People have said this. You know, critics of Hariri and Haririism, if you can say that, have said, well, you know, Hariri got involved in politics really to dominate Lebanon's business, dominate Lebanon's economic arena, that there's a very unhealthy marriage between politics and business in this respect, and that he is, and they've said things about his son, for example, Saad Hariri, that he basically runs his political movement as an extension of his business interests. Similarly, people have said things about Hezbollah, similar things, that, you know, they're only involved in politics so that they can preserve their military resistance against Israel. So they're not politicians. They are first and foremost dedicated to resistance against Israel, and that's the only reason they're in politics. And that's the reason why they take these little pathetic portfolios like agriculture and administrative affairs, because at the end of the day, all they're interested in government for is to, you know, maintain their interests in the resistance sphere. When it comes to the FPM, that's not true. They're mm-hmm. not, say what you want about them, but they're not huge businessmen. There are wealthy individuals who are involved at the higher levels, but they're not, you know, anywhere near a Hariri or a Mikati. We could also say a Mikati, here's somebody again who is a major business magnet and tycoon, mm-hmm. and he's getting involved in politics. The FPM is, are first and foremost, they want to be politicians. They want to be involved in government. They want to get into the nitty-gritty of reform. At least the ones I've spoken to, some of the cadres, some of the people who are sort of senior officers, but not quite at the level of MPs and ministers, that they are have a genuine interest in governance. And this is something new in Lebanese politics, I would say. This is a party that is, you know, that has many flaws, that is inconsistent, that definitely has problems, you know, sticking to its reform principles, and has sold out in many ways. But I think that there is a difference of genre here between the FPM and some of these other parties.
Well, I think that's fascinating, and I think your description of General Aoun as maddening couldn't be more spot on.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. If you get beyond General Aoun, it is going to be very interesting to see, because certainly for the FPM, one of the key planks of their political platform has been reform, cleaning up corruption, et cetera. These are issues that resonate, I would say, in light of the Arab Spring, even more so today than before. The other issue I think to bear in mind is, as always with Lebanon, when one looks at politics, one has to unfortunately look at the confessional divisions and even divisions within particular communities. And as we know, the Christian community in Lebanon is very much divided, with some siding with March 14th and others siding with March 8th. I'm curious what you think, Elias, in terms of does this newfound political power for the FPM and General Aoun, how do you think that's going to resonate within the Christian community?
Well, they're definitely positioned to make a major power grab here. You know, it's a truism of Lebanese politics that the Shiites are already all, basically locked up. They support Hezbollah and Amal. There's no real inroads to be made there by Shiite politicians who are not affiliated with the two major parties. Same thing goes for the Sunnis, although less to a lesser extent, but mostly, you know, the Future Movement is the big, you know, it's the heavyweight on the scene there. And we may see Najib Mikati try to make inroads with his, he and his allies in this new ministry are mostly from Tripoli. And so he may be making a bid there to kind of erode Saad Hariri's status as the Sunni heavyweight in Lebanon. But the Christians are divided. They're divided between March 14th and March 8th. And, you know, it's always difficult to tell where exactly, clearly I think Michel Aoun is the single most popular Christian leader. Mm-hmm. He's more popular than the other ones. But his popularity, we definitely saw a dip in his popularity in the 2009 election,
right.
2009 elections, vis-a-vis his 2005 showing. The question is now, you know, can they really kind of eviscerate their opponents, take this opportunity now to emerge as, you know, portray themselves as the only credible Christian choice. And the FPM has tried, you know, they style themselves as a non-confessional party and one that's dedicated to a non-confessional, non-sectarian Lebanon as a, you know, a policy-oriented party, as a party that's interested in policy and not in, in sectarian representation. But they've had to play the sectarian representation game. And Michel Aoun has definitely styled himself as the leader of the Christians, not just in Lebanon, but in the Levant. He's made trips to Syria to pretend like, you know, he is the leader of Syria's Christians and so on. So they're kind of trying to walk that line between sectarian representation, sectarian politics, and the other stuff. When you talk to FPM officials about this kind of, you know, language that they use, they'll say that it's all in the service of their greater politics. They say, well, Lebanon is, to some extent, a confessional sectarian country, and so we have to play that game in order to get the power that we want in order to make reform possible on all these different levels. Well, now they've kind of reached that point. They have never been as powerful as they are today. They've never held as many portfolios. They've never had – I mean, you could imagine that they could have had this many portfolios in a national unity government. And that would still have been a huge deal. But March 14th would have held a blocking veto. In this situation, they have 10 portfolios, and there's nobody standing in their way. They have no excuse now not to really go after all the programs they wanted, that they're interested in.
Well, I would agree with that. I think it's going to be, in terms of people that watch Lebanese internal politics, I agree with you. I think that's going to be something to watch, particularly as the 2013 parliamentary elections approach. And precisely that, is the FPM able to translate this newfound power in the cabinet into greater winnings and more parliamentary seats in the 2013 elections. I'm going to push back on one thing you said, which is that, yes, I would agree the Shia, the lock on the Shia population is held by Hezbollah and Amal. I am increasingly starting to wonder about the Sunni population and whether or not Prime Minister Mikati, together with some of his Sunni allies, in particular Mohammed Safadi, who has a primary position within the cabinet, these are Tripoli-based Sunni politicians. I think there is some disillusionment within the Sunni community with Saad Hariri. And one wonders whether we're going to actually see a shift within the community over the coming months, and depending, again, on the success of this government. If it's successful, is Mikati able to translate that into greater leadership and influence of the Sunni community? I think it's up in the air. And I think particularly because they have got control over these ministries through the government, I think he's going to focus in very much on the Akkar region in North Lebanon, which is a very impoverished Sunni-dominated region. He's talked about the need to implement programming there and to deal with many of the socioeconomic problems that are
there. Who's this, Mikati, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether he then is able to do that, and in so doing, take away the mantle of leadership of the Sunni community from Saad Hariri and assume it for himself.
I think, I think that's totally spot on. And I think it's very plausible. Because, if there's one thing, at the end of the day, people like to say that Lebanese politics is all about money and all about that, if you have enough money, basically have much more, that money is much more important than anything else. And to some extent, that is true. But when you look at the various major parties and kind of connect them with their sects and so on, I don't think it's insignificant that these major parties, the ones that continue to have dominance year after year, decade after decade, are led by very charismatic individuals and people who had some way of connecting with an audience. Hezbollah is a classic example. Nasrallah is probably the most gifted orator of his generation. Mm-hmm. Nabih Birri also has real charisma. People like to have some, they feel like they want to be able to latch on to some kind of aspect of their leader's personality. Michel Aoun, again, very colorful, very charismatic. People love his style. Samir Jaja, also, very at home in front of a crowd. Najib Mikati is also, I think, very charismatic and very capable of holding his own in an interview. He speaks Arabic perfectly. He speaks English perfectly. Now, Rafiq Hariri, Saad's father, also had his own style. He wasn't a kind of pulpit preacher, but he definitely had a certain kind of charisma. Saad Hariri's major weakness is that, I don't think it's the fact that he doesn't speak Arabic very well. I mean, classical Arabic. His problem is that he's just not charismatic. And he doesn't have, he disappears for these long stretches.
Yeah.
He's been out of the country now for months. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt that the Americans and the Saudis are saying that there is some kind of plot against his life. That may be true, but you can give a press conference from anywhere, and when you're the outgoing prime minister of Lebanon and somebody with his stature, anytime you want to give a press conference, people are going to listen. And he just doesn't do that. When he was prime minister, he was out of the country most of the time. And he hardly ever communicates with the people. And I think there is a huge void there to be filled. Mikati, he's got a long way ahead of him before he can build the kind of patronage system that the future movement possesses. But I think that's one thing that, the Syrians and Hezbollah and some of Hariri's opponents are banking on, that over the next couple of years, we're going to see the Sunni kind of political arena become much more fragmented and look much more like the Christian one than the Shiite one.
I think that's right. And I think even with respect to the patronage system, reports indicate that money that used to flow fairly freely from Saudi Arabia is not flowing anymore.
Right.
And, of course, the Saudis and the Syrians more so are more concerned, I think, with issues that have to do with the Arab Spring, in the Saudi case, Bahrain, and perhaps Syria, and, of course, in the Syrian case, Syria. And I think there are some huge issues there.
Right.
I think you and I could probably go on and on about Lebanese internal politics, but maybe we should direct the discussion a little bit now toward some of these other issues, namely the STL and Syria.
Yeah.
I guess for me, that let's maybe... I'd maybe talk very briefly about the STL, although I actually think of the two, the one that's going to be much more important is going to be what happens in Syria. But as I noted earlier, so the tribunal is expected, has long been expected, to issue indictments that will name Hezbollah. And it has been thought that this could, because of the sectarian dimension of it, could really unleash some very significant violence inside Lebanon. You know, the notion that a Shiite militant organization would be held responsible for the assassination of the primary leader of the Sunni community, I think for Lebanon Sunnis is beyond the pale. And so I think there are understandable concerns that when this indictment is issued, it could, in fact, unleash fairly significant sectarian violence. The other school of thought, though, is that there has been so much done by Hezbollah through the various press conferences and speeches that Hassan Nasrallah has been giving, particularly last summer, where he basically called out the UN and said, yeah, we're going to be named. We know we're going to be named, but this is basically an American-Israeli plot. He's gone on and on and attempted to discredit the tribunal. One wonders whether, as a result, the actual issuance of the indictments will be somewhat anticlimactic with respect to Lebanon, inside Lebanon, particularly in light of everything else that's going on. It's my sense that that may, in fact, be the case, but that, in other words, once the indictments are issued, they name Hezbollah, it'll be a blip, but it won't be all-out sectarian violence and riots and demonstrations in Beirut and notably in Tripoli. Yeah. What's your sense?
That's right. I think the day that they're published, there'll be a big press conference. It'll be all anybody wants to talk about. But Hezbollah is going to come out here. Their talking points are very clear. They're going to come out and say, we called it. We knew, you know. This is nothing new. Everybody knows. They've been after us. They think that they want to pin this on us. This is old news. This is unoriginal. And, you know, this is a big plot. Their allies are going to say, you know, the trial or the investigation we've seen has been compromised from the very beginning. There have been suspicions of false testimony. There have been leaks. You know, there's been all kinds of problems with this tribunal, and we're going to wait and see. But we're not holding our breath. But and then their opponents, again, they're out of the government. They're the leader of their opposition is in Paris. You know, so. I think you're right. It's going to be anticlimactic. The point at which it could begin to have some kind of effect on the political scene is when the thing actually goes to trial and when mm-hmm. they're actually unveiling evidence. But in order to get to that point, they have to bring accused, the people who are being indicted, to trial. And that's where it starts to get a little bit dicey.
I was just going to say, well, I think that's right, although Hezbollah has certainly made clear, Nasrallah has made very, very clear that there will be no arrests of any Hezbollah operatives, and Lebanese armed forces have essentially said the same thing. And in fact, it seems the UN has acknowledged this by allowing, for the first time since the Nuremberg trials, allowing this trial to be held in absentia. So,
right.
Which in and of itself, I think, also begins to undermine somewhat the credibility of the process.
Yeah, and it also... you know, there is that possibility of trial in absentia, but I think not before not before they've exhausted all other pathways to bring people who are arrested to trial. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they can say, okay, you know, we're just going to skip that part and just go straight to absentia. They're going to say, these are the individuals who have to be arrested, and you, Lebanon, are obliged to participate to cooperate with this investigation and bring these people to justice. So there's gonna be a very delicate phase, I think, where the Mikati government is going to have to come up with some reason for why they cannot arrest people. You know, maybe some of those people are not around. Maybe some of them are dead. Maybe, you know, nobody's seen them. but if there are people who are senior members of the party who are around, who are being indicted, Miketi is going to have to be. This government is going to have to say, we can't go out. They're going to have to take a stand. My point is, mm-hmm. and they can't just say, they can't mention the pink elephant in the room, which is that even if we wanted to go after these people, Hezbollah would never let us. You know, they're going to have to come up. They're going to have to finesse it in some way.
No, I agree. And I think you've actually put your finger on probably one of the biggest challenges that the Mikati government is going to have, because the rest of the world is certainly going to be watching very closely what the Lebanese government does with respect to the UN tribunal. And in fact, certainly statements issued by the United States, by France and others, is that they are going to watch very closely and are expecting Lebanon to respect and adhere to its international agreements, namely the tribunal. As we know, I mean, the government initially collapsed because Hezbollah's pressuring of the government of Saad Hariri to essentially disavow the tribunal was unsuccessful, and so Hezbollah pulled out and the government collapsed. I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how Prime Minister Mikati navigates this very, very tricky issue. I think he's made very clear in his statements he's very sensitive to the possibilities of international isolation if Lebanon does not cooperate. And at the same time, he's got to manage his alliance, namely Hezbollah. And so my sense is he's going to take some kind of middle-of-the-road position where the Lebanese can't be called out for blatantly disavowing the tribunal, but where they also aren't going to cooperate fully. He said things like, well, you know, we can't do much unless we have a national consensus on the tribunal, which for me suggests maybe Prime Minister Mikati will try something like, well, we need to take up the tribunal at the national dialogue table, which is essentially the same as consigning it to oblivion.
Right.
You know, or let's have the parliament discuss it. I think he's going to do something like that, essentially try to punt the issue.
Yeah.
So that it gives enough of a fig leaf so that governments like the United States and France won't pull support, but enough of a delay tactic to keep Hezbollah in particular off his tail. What's your sense?
Yeah, that's probably it. You know, it'll we're just going to have to see, because the devil will be in the details. And you know, he's got two constituencies here that he has to deal with. One is the international community, and the other is his internal Sunni, you know, constituency. If he bungles that, and if you know, he's going to try to walk a narrow line, as we're saying, but if he's sort of not dead center on it, that opens up an opportunity for Saad Hariri to kind of come after him,
mm-hmm.
and get the Sunnis you know, really angry about this, and you know, and portray Mikati as selling Sunni dignity and Sunni, you know, honor and so on down the river, and that he's basically succumbing to Hezbollah pressure and Syrian pressure. So he has a very tough job. I don't envy him this job. And I was a little bit confused, you know, when I was very surprised when Hezbollah pulled out of the when they brought down the Hariri cabinet, because there's only so much that somebody other than Saad Hariri can do. Vis-a-vis the STL,
mm-hmm.
as far as you know, limiting its consequences in Lebanon,
You're saying this because he's the son of.
He's
the
son of the
leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I think in an ideal world, Hezbollah wanted Saad Hariri to be the one to cast doubt on the legitimacy and the credibility of this tribunal. They wanted him to do it because Lebanon Sunnis and other, you know, partisans of the March 14th movement would have had. You know, if they're going to believe it, or if they're going to accept that the STL is politicized,
mm-hmm.
or that it's not a, you know, they're barking up the wrong tree, if they're going to just accept that, whether or not they believe it, they would have to take it from somebody else. They would have to take it from Saad Hariri himself. Anybody else doing that could easily be portrayed as a Syrian stooge, as a Hezbollah stooge, and so on. So I think it's very, you know, I don't know that this is going to work, that this gambit of Hezbollah's is going to work, to have a different Sunni politician, albeit one who has, you know, good ties with the Saudis and the Americans, whether he is going to be able to do the job they want him to do.
One question I've always had is, it seems as though the one issue with the treaty governing the tribunal is that it was never endorsed by the Lebanese parliament. Is
yeah.
That's correct, right? So could you envision a scenario where Prime Minister Mikati says, okay, well, we're going to submit the treaty now to the parliament for a vote on endorsing it?
Yeah.
In other words, using a ploy of democratic procedure, attempt to throw it to the parliament, and either it gets stuck there, or the same majority, however slight, that put Najib Mikati ahead of Saad Hariri as the prime minister ends up through a Democrat, you know, in quotation marks, Democratic vote, voting against endorsing the treaty. Is that a possibility?
I don't know that they could do it sort of ex post facto, because it wasn't ratified by the parliament.
Right.
That's true. That's because parliament was, you know, frozen at the time. And so that's why they went to Chapter 7 and so on. So I think Lebanon would still be bound. You know, that's already happened. So now Lebanon's bound by the UN's because Lebanon is a signatory to the United Nations, and they're bound by all these conventions. So I don't know. I mean, it's very interesting to see what they're going to do, how they're going to, you know, they can't stop the train. The tribunal has, it's already left the station.
Right.
You know, the investigation is done, or it's still ongoing, but it's basically done, and it's going to a trial. It's going to be bad press, you know, for Hezbollah. But I think Hezbollah would be satisfied if they can just find a way if Mikati can find a way to finesse the whole arresting suspects thing.
Right.
And if he can sort of say, you know, we're not prepared to judge, if they can keep sort of kicking the ball down the road, you know, the indictments came out, okay, we're going to wait and see till the trial. And, oh, as for those suspects, well, some of them are not, we can't find them, you know. And so they're going to have to be tried in absentia. So we're just going to wait and see. And eventually, I think Hezbollah can live with that.
Mm-hmm.
What they can't live with is if this were not a Mikati government, if this were a Hariri government, and there was a real confrontation between Lebanon's security forces, the internal security forces, and Hezbollah's security forces, that's something that they want to avoid. They don't want to be seen to be fighting the Lebanese army or the Lebanese security forces over a UN warrant, arrest warrants.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's ugly for them. And so if they can get around that, you know, and just have this trial taking place, you know, far away in the Netherlands, and no matter what they come up with, even if the evidence is incredibly compelling, Hezbollah will always have its own narrative, and they'll always be able to sell it to certain people. And I think they're betting that the rest of Lebanon is just not going to care anymore.
Yeah, so. I you know what? I think that does sound exactly right. I think beyond whatever might be happening in The Hague with the tribunal, what's going to be far more important and what eclipses this by far is what happens right next door in Syria.
Yeah.
In a funny way, I think that the escalating uprising in Syria really turns the STL into nothing more, frankly, than an asterisk. Because I think from Hezbollah's perspective, certainly the far bigger concern now has to be the stability or lack thereof of the Assad regime and what that means for them. I certainly think I myself have a hard time envisioning how Bashar al-Assad gets out of this. He may well repress the protests in the short term, although even that now is looking a little bit less sure. But my own sense is that the international condemnation and isolation that he's going to bring down upon himself and the fraying of control that clearly seems to be taking place is such that he will ultimately be the cause of his own undoing. And with that comes a whole slew of questions with respect, certainly to Syria, but also to Lebanon.
Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, that's the big story right now. And it's so interesting to see that, you know, the Lebanese aren't really talking about it. You know, you don't see a real vibrant discussion in the Lebanese press or on Lebanese talk shows about what's happening in Syria and the implications on Lebanon. Mm. And, you know, people are still talking about the STL, like that's going to be the big deciding factor on the future shape of Lebanese politics. When they don't talk about Syria, and I think that I think it's because people are very, very afraid.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody is afraid for different reasons. The people who are close to Syria, like Hezbollah and Ahmad and the Free Patriotic Movement, are, well, let's just say the big Shiite parties are afraid of their backing and their stature, you know, in the kind of their foreign policy, sort of the Syrian, Iranian, Hamas, Hezbollah axis is now in danger.
Mm-hmm.
The Christians the Christian parties in general are a little bit worried about, even those who don't like the Assad regime are worried about what would happen in Syria if the Assad regime fell.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen to those minorities and so on. And they're worried about refugee crises, you know, people coming to Lebanon from Syria. And the Sunnis, I think, are also worried. You definitely have people who are very vocal about what's happening in Syria, who have expressed strong criticism of the Assad regime. But I think people just don't know, you know, because it could be the potential for a momentous, sort of cataclysmic, epical, whatever adjective we want to use, shift in Lebanese politics is so, you know, is finally palpable that people just don't know how to handle it or how to talk about it.
I agree. I mean, you almost get the sense that you've got the Lebanese kind of just, you know, putting their heads down and hoping against hope that the whole thing just goes away, because I think it is so enormous in terms of its implications that it's difficult to even begin to comprehend what it would mean. But I mean, from my perspective, it is really very interesting to think about. Again, I think there's some fairly clear spillover effects that we've already seen, some limited refugee flows, some amount of sectarian tension, particularly in Tripoli. My sense is we'll probably continue to see those kinds of things take place sporadically. If everything kind of goes to pot in Syria, who knows what that would mean. But I, for me, the bigger questions are the strategic ones, in particular with respect to Hezbollah. And what calculation does Hassan Nasrallah make? What is Hezbollah's plan B, basically, if the Syrian regime collapses or Syria somehow falls into to some sort of chaos where they've got minimal control? You know, what kinds of fallback plans could one imagine Hassan Nasrallah making? I mean, first of all, the conduit of arms that they get, which is why Syria in part is so important to Hezbollah, could well be lost. And that has, I think, huge implications for the strategic balance of parity with Israel. But beyond that, it's sort of I think it becomes almost an existential question for Hezbollah.
Yeah, I mean, they faced something kind of like this before in 2000 when Syria was had reached a very advanced stage of peace negotiations with Israel. Mm. And, you know, it looked like they were about to, you know, sign the deal on the Golan. And Nasrallah there was an interview with him at that point, and they were, you know, and he was asked point blank, you know, what do you do if one of your major sponsors is now at peace with Israel? And he said, and the expectation is that once Syria signs peace with Israel, Lebanon follows, because it, you know, for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. And Nasrallah basically said, you know, we're not going to resist Syria's decision. That's up to them. And we're not going to, you know, resist the Lebanese decision. If the Lebanese decide that's what they want to do, that's what they'll do. But we are not going to accept that. You know, we're not going to bomb the Israeli embassy in Lebanon, Beirut, but we're not going to, you know, we won't recognize it as a party, basically. Mm-hmm. I think that they have done their calculations. They realize that what's going on is very serious. But Hezbollah is they're a very careful, calculating party, and they have a lot of assets besides this whole resistance thing. In Lebanon, they have, they're definitely the most energized party. Mm-hmm. They see themselves as on the rise. They're incredibly organized. And, you know, in a way, I think that they've already begun to start shifting, you know, ever since the 2006 war, when a new sort of set of rules was established between Israel and Hezbollah, as far as conflict was concerned. It wasn't going to be tit for tat anymore. It was going to be a tit for enormous, you know, catastrophic annihilation of Lebanon.
Tit for annihilation. I like that.
Right, exactly. That they, you know, since 2006, it's been 5 years now. There hasn't been a single incident, a single security incident between Hezbollah and Israel. So in a certain way, they have, you know, they have tacitly accepted that strategy works. Mm. And so they've already kind of moved into a whole new model.
Yeah.
And so if the situation in Syria gets even worse, then they kind of have to, you know, revise that. You know what I mean? So I don't think that they're beyond the whole kind of like guerrilla movement mindset anyway. And they're moving towards something else, but that process might be accelerated by what's happening in Syria.
No, I tend to think that's correct, although, you know, you referenced Nasrallah's interview in 2000, but the Hezbollah of today is a very different one from the one in 2000. It's a much more powerful, ascendant movement, even despite the losses that the community took in the 2006 war. You know, I think the withdrawal of the Israelis, the withdrawal of Syria in 2005, And frankly, at least in the immediate aftermath of the 2006 war, we have seen an ascendant Hezbollah, which I think even in the relationship with Syria, that balance of power has shifted significantly from where it was in 2000. And so I tend to find myself of two minds in terms of how Hezbollah handles this. On the one hand, one could see where they've built up this incredible arsenal that's even more sophisticated and powerful and numerous than the arsenal that it had built up prior to the 2006 war. So it certainly has got a lot of firepower that it's sitting on, and hence this sort of strategic deterrence, the state of the strategic deterrence that has taken place between Hezbollah and Israel. The question is, to what extent does Hezbollah see and understand the need ultimately to translate its power as a resistance movement into power and dynamism as a fully fledged Lebanese political movement? And you're right. I mean, on some level, we're already seeing it increasingly take on positions of, again, just two portfolio positions this time, but part of an alliance that now dominates the government. So it is inching its way ever slowly into the more formal structures of government in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, does Hassan Nasrallah make a calculation that with the loss of Syria, if that should happen, that really the game needs to be played inside Lebanon and that its evolution as a political power is really the way to go? We can imagine many scenarios in which that turns out not to be the case.
Yeah, well, I think as long as the Arab-Israeli conflict is still there, then they're never going to drop the resistance aspect. And even if Syria goes and changes, they're gonna bet that the Arab-Israeli conflict will remain a theme, a cause that is important for a majority of Arabs, Lebanese and non-Lebanese, and it's a cause that they are very committed to. And so even if their one of their principal backers goes, and is replaced by somebody else, that doesn't mean that Syrians, ordinary Syrians, don't care about the Palestinian cause.
Right.
And even the people who are Bashar al-Assad is not being, people aren't protesting against him because he is a member of the resistance axis. Most Syrians, even the ones who are on the street, remain committed to the Palestinian cause and want the Golan back. And if anything, if any criticism could be leveled against Bashar by some of those protesters, is that he has not been activist enough, that he is funding, some people have made the critique that he is actually, a de facto ally of Israel, and Israel wants him to stay because he has kept the border so quiet. So I think Hezbollah is betting that, even if he goes and another government comes in, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or something else, that government is going to have to pay homage to that. They're going to have to kind of play the resistance game to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
That they can't just do a Sadat and sign peace with Israel and expect that in this new, brave new world, post-Arab Spring, that's going to work.
Right. No, I agree with that. I think, unfortunately, though, that the prospects for any sort of peace near term anyway are quite slim. And I think the concern more would be, is there another renewed conflict either between Lebanon and Israel or Syria and Israel? Bashar al-Assad is not going to go quietly. That's for sure. He has signaled already with now two incidents on the border with Israel, the Golan. This sort of rushing of the border by Palestinians, which could not take place without the acquiescence of the government, the Syrian government. One wonders whether, as some kind of last-ditch effort, Bashar provokes some sort of conflict with Israel, either directly in some way or more likely through Lebanon. I mean, do you see that as a possibility? And would Hezbollah go along with that kind of plan, understanding what the risks are to its community and to a community that I think is frankly war weary, to say the least?
Yeah, I don't think that they could. I don't think he could use Hezbollah. I think Hezbollah has gotten too big to really engage again in that old sort of tit for tat method.
Mm-hmm.
around, you know, in the 90s, that was still possible. They were still a little guerrilla outfit that could do these little skirmishes. Now Hezbollah is it's the biggest party, one of the biggest parties in Lebanon. It's just not the kind of, you don't use it in that kind of a fight. And I think that Hezbollah is also, you know, their relationship with the Syrians has gotten more complicated. It's something that very few people understand. It's an unclear relationship there. They're always on the same page with each other. I think there are issues of mistrust, between Hezbollah and Syria. I think certain elements in Hezbollah suspect that the Syrians, you know, killed Ahmad Mughni, for example, as a way of getting off the hook with the STL. So, you know, we're no longer living in a world where Syria or Bashar can say, okay, go create a border incident, and you know, Israel will kill 1,000 people, but you know, it's in the interests of the resistance axis. I think that the world is changing now, and but that's not to say that he won't play the conflict card in some way. Mm-hmm. There could be some other kind of, some other kind of outfits to do that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Clearly, lots to look for in the coming coming days, weeks, and months.
I wanted to ask you just before we end. Yeah. There was one other major thing and something you'll know a lot more about than myself, is this new U.S. draft legislation against Lebanon.
The bill is new in the sense of having been announced, but it's been in the works for some period of time, even prior to the announcement of the new government. I think there have been growing concerns on Capitol Hill about what's happening in Lebanon, about the shifting of the balance of power that we've been talking about inside Lebanon.
This is the HATA, Hezbollah Anti-Terrorism Act, that was just announced by a bipartisan committee, Howard Berman, Daryl Issa, various others.
Charles Bustani from it's very interesting that the co-sponsors include a number of prominent Lebanese American lawmakers. So that says something in and of itself. It's hard to know what the actual real effect of the bill is going to have in terms of assistance to Lebanon. Essentially, the bill stipulates, which is already U.S. law, that taxpayers' money cannot go to a foreign terrorist organization, namely Hezbollah.
Right.
So it simply reemphasizes something that has already been the case both in law and certainly in practice. Now, there are others on the Hill, such as the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elena Rose Leighton from Florida, who are staking a more strident position and calling for all assistance to Lebanon to be cut off.
Mm-hmm.
As it is, there's an effective, I think, freeze on certainly on lethal assistance to the Lebanese armed forces.
Yeah.
And so the real question is, I think, going to be one of nuance and degree in terms of what the real impact on the ground is vis-a-vis U.S. assistance to Lebanon.
Yeah.
I think it's a fair bet to say that we're certainly not going to see any significant aid, I don't think, to the LAF.
Mm-hmm.
The big question is what happens to other aid programs, which are still, even by this bill, going to be preserved. But, you know, we also have to understand that we're in an atmosphere in Washington with tremendous concern about the budget deficit and the debt ceiling and other things. And so funding for international assistance writ large is being reduced. So in a country like Lebanon, where there is a government that is perceived as potentially not being favorable to the United States, I think it is far more vulnerable to have a portion of its aid, if not all of it, frozen or cut significantly.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably what we're looking at going forward. My own sense is we need to be quite careful because it's a very delicate game where U.S. influence is already diminishing by virtue of this government. And so I think it's fair to ask the question in cutting off aid, if that's the route that we eventually end up going, are we simply ceding the ground to our adversaries, namely Iran? I think Syria probably less so given the trouble that Syria is in today. Although, who knows? So I think it's a very, very difficult question, and there are no easy answers. I would note, though, that the State Department has said and taken a position of we want to wait and see. We want to watch, and we will judge this government by its actions. And I think that's a very, to me, that's a very sensible position to take. And as I noted earlier, my own sense is that I think Najib Mikati is a pretty sharp guy, and I think he's going to be very careful to try and make sure that the Lebanese government does not undertake policies that are so objectionable that they draw the ire of the international community. And, of course, the other thing to note, all the legislation with respect to Hezbollah, remember, Hezbollah has no more cabinet portfolios than it did in the Saad Hariri government. It has the exact same ones.
Yeah.
So its actual participation in the government is the same as it's always been.
Right, exactly. Well, I think that's I think we've exhausted everything we were going to talk about. So thank you. Well,
thank you, Elias. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, indeed. And hope to do this again soon.
Indeed. Take care.
Okay.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye-bye.